Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. Now, this is one interview that I've really been looking forward to. We're chatting to someone who very likely will be among the first people to set foot on the surface of another planet, and among the first people in history who is very likely to be born on one planet and to die on another planet. She's just 33 years old, has a PhD in physics, where she wrote her dissertation in quantum biology. She also has a master's degree in physics where she focused on quantum cryptography. And now she's one of three South Africans who's been shortlisted as part of a global project to put people on Mars in the early 2030s, about 15 or so years from now. I am, of course, talking about Dr. Adriana Marais, who recently joined business software giant SAP as head of innovation for Africa. Adriana, thank you so much for making time to talk to us on Tech Central.
Thanks for having me, Duncan. My pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Before we get to Mars and interplanetary travel, tell me a bit about your upbringing. I understand you're a Durban girl, is that right?
Pietermaritzburg, actually, yes.
Okay.
So, although I was born in the Eastern Cape.
Okay.
So I've moved to the big cities of South Africa later in life. I had a wonderful childhood playing outdoors a lot. I wasn't the kid reading science textbooks inside or even playing with science kits. No, we were dressing up and doing theater productions and playing hide and seek and building forts outside. I think maybe we were amongst the last generation of kids that really used our imaginations when we played.
Okay.
So I look back on my childhood with immense pleasure. Good fun times, roller skating gangs and all sorts.
So if you weren't watching or reading sci-fi and that sort of thing, how did the interest in physics come about?
It didn't really. I mean, at school I actually didn't really like science that much. Of course, the subject matter probably wasn't the subject that's sometimes portrayed to you. So I think the school system has a lot to think about in terms of making subjects enticing and exciting to students, I think. So my mom actually convinced me not to drop science just to keep my options open, and I'm grateful to her for that, having gone on to do a PhD in physics. She just said, keep your options open. If you want to do a BSc, keep science, keep maths, because these are the two you really need. So I did. And in first year university, I applied to study jazz and didn't get into the program because I didn't have music as a subject. So I could do it through UNISA and wait for 1 year and then reapply again. I thought, no, okay, I've always wanted to be an astronaut, so let me just do theoretical physics.
So there was some interest there, right?
I wanted to be an astronaut, yes, an explorer, I would say. So the sitting indoors in a lab doing maths calculations, not so much, although I always have loved maths. The exploring part of it was what drew me to physics. This idea that you probably needed a physics degree to be able to get to go to space. So I studied physics, and then by second, third year, when I had become slightly more studious and started attending some of the lectures, I really became fascinated with quantum physics. I think it was in third year when I asked my first question and went to the lecturer's office after the lecture and asked the first question that I'd ever asked, which showed, okay, now I'm interested. Now you've got me. Yeah.
Fascinating. So where did you go to school? Where did you matriculate?
Pietermaritzburg, St. John's.
St. John's, yes. Okay. And then you went to study at the University of Natal or KwaZulu-Natal?
No, I went to Cape Town as far away as possible from where I grew up. I was keen to get out.
You did come back to KZN and study there.
Yes, so then the quantum research group was established. Actually, this phone call is interesting. I was in Japan at the time working in a bar, and my mom called at sort of 2 a.m., which was her sort of dinner time or whatever.
Right.
I was awake, of course, working in the bar. She said, did you hear that there's a professor at UKZN who's starting a quantum research group? He's just been given several millions of funding from the government. Don't you think this is a nice opportunity to come back home? So I wasn't convinced that this was really true. She was just trying to get me to come back somehow. So I Googled it and found out, yes, Prof. Francesco Petruccione had established the quantum research group in Durban. And that's what brought me back to Durban, back to South Africa and back to Durban.
Okay. What were you doing in Japan?
Taking a break from studying after finishing honors in theoretical physics at the University of Cape Town, I decided I wanted to travel. So I went to England, lived in Brighton for a bit, then went to Japan and lived there for a year and a half.
Okay. So when you were a kid and you were dreaming of being an astronaut and exploring the universe, what were you thinking about? Were you thinking about Mars at that time, or where did you want to go?
No. So Mars... Yeah, Mars is the natural destination, especially looking at the two neighboring planets, Venus or Mars. Mars is, you know, Venus is hundreds of degrees Celsius on the surface, has sulfuric acid rain. There are many problems with living on the surface of Mars. Living in an orbital station several kilometers above the surface could be an option, and some people have looked into that. But the surface is not a good place to be compared to the surface of Mars, which is sort of negative 50 degrees Celsius, something we can get our heads around. The gravity is, you know, a bit more than a third of that on Earth. So there are many, many good aspects compared to Venus for living on the surface of Mars. So Mars is a natural choice. But as a child, I think I didn't really have a clear concept of which planet. I just knew I wanted to go and find another world that would be livable besides the one that we're on, because there must be more out there.
Okay. I want to get back and talk about Mars One a bit later in this podcast, but I'm particularly interested in some of the research you did during your studies. You did a master's degree where you focused on quantum cryptography. We're an ICT website and podcast, so I think a lot of our listeners will be interested in knowing more about that. I've heard the term before, but what exactly is quantum cryptography, and what did your research studies focus on specifically?
So after my master's, I actually dropped that field of study, and there was a quote in the beginning of, well, one of the quotes in my thesis was, two can keep a secret if one is dead. And I think that remains true. Another one was that by JFK, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. So at the time, I was quite against this whole encryption, you know, contributing my knowledge towards keeping secrets. However, now I've completely reversed on that, because now with the general data protection regulations in the European Union coming out next May, I think the whole idea of keeping secrets has been turned around, and it's not about governments keeping secrets anymore. It's about protecting personal data, which has now become an asset. So an asset which is worth money. And I think we need to start controlling how this is used in the business world. And now I think encrypting information has become important from the side of the individual, as well as from the side of keeping, you know, bank or government or other big institution secrets, which I was kind of against at the time. So now I'm really grateful that Prof. Petruccione told me that this is a mature field of technological studies, and quantum physics will probably be the first commercialized quantum technology, and indeed it is. And I'm grateful that I have a lot of knowledge on that now. So in fact, just last week I was in Geneva visiting, so previously academic, but the first commercializers of quantum encryption devices, ID Quantique, a company in Switzerland. Former collaborators and colleagues of ours since back 10 years ago. I think Francesco has known them or more. So it's great to see that this is really mature technology now. So what it does basically, you can use quantum mechanics to generate random numbers. So if you know anything about hashing or encrypting, you need randomness. You need strings of random numbers to be keys, to do hashing, etc. And where these random numbers come from is often a pseudo-random source rather than a truly random source. So as far as we know, the reality around us at a quantum mechanical level is truly random. There's no theory that's more fundamental than quantum mechanics that proves otherwise. So at the moment, for example, the measurement of a superposition state, if you've heard of properties that are uniquely quantum mechanical, you would have heard of superposition. So you can be in a superposition of one characteristic and another, and if you measure it if you prepare the state correctly, with 50% probability you measure one, and with 50% probability the other, if it's prepared in that way. So the outcome of the measurements in some sense then is perfectly random in terms of being one or the other, and this can be a way to generate random bit strings, which can then be used in existing encryption systems to provide an extra tier of quantum security, if you want to call it that. Quantum key distribution, so generating a key on site is one thing, but if you want to distribute a key, which is usually the case between two parties, A and B, who are not in the same location, then you have the trouble of trying to distribute the key, and this is the age-old problem of, do you send a trusted courier, you know, a guy on a horse, or, you know, some kind of a dark fiber optic cable, you know, you name it, depending what technology you want to use, but how can you protect this message? And I won't go into details now, but using quantum mechanics, you can distribute the key, not the message, but the key. And any disruptions in the signal are detectable. Any eavesdropping is detectable. So in the worst case, you never distribute the key. But in the best case, you have a key that you know has not been interrupted or detected or measured in any way by anyone else. So in that way, then you can go ahead and transfer the message using this key.
So are we talking about completely secure, unbreakable encryption here?
Yes. So theoretically, and I'm a theorist, it is perfectly secure. Of course, the reality of building these devices always comes with some small issues that need to be dealt with in the engineering sense, but compared to currently existing systems that are just difficult to break, and that's why we have to keep increasing the key length and so on, because it's assumed that the computational power of the greatest adversary is around this amount, and then we push the security at that level, but we don't really know what the computing power is of some adversary. So with a quantum encryption system, this is theoretically secure. So even if you have a quantum computer, you will not be able to crack this method.
How far are we from seeing this technology in practice?
Oh, you can buy it already.
You can
buy a USB device that generates random numbers from this company. I said they are the only commercializers of this technology so far for a few hundred euros. This device plus a whole system. Yeah, they have a website you can order online, etc.
Okay.
Not to be a pun, but these are ex-collaborators of ours. Happy to see that they are commercializing what we studied decades
absolutely.
Ago.
Yeah. I mean, we could probably talk about this subject for the rest of this podcast, but there's so much else we need to get onto. Just very briefly, your doctorate in quantum biology. What is that?
So I think across the sphere, in our investigations, whether it be in business or science, we're becoming more efficient, more optimized, looking at things on more fine-grained scales. And the idea that by looking at individual molecules and living systems, we are finding properties and characteristics that we hadn't known about before is part of this trend. So I think the miniaturization of processes in computing is going towards the quantum computer, where we really manipulate single particles to do the kind of processes that we want to do in computing. Also in the body, we're wanting to deliver drugs effectively, not sort of the sledgehammer approach that has been the approach in medicine for so many centuries, which hasn't really changed a lot up till now, to be honest. And that's because we don't really understand the interaction between large molecules precisely. So how does a specific drug interact with a specific protein?
At the molecular level.
At the molecular level. So we can do tests, trial and error, and this is how we typically do administer medicines, through trial and error. I think we're going to be entering an era soon where we're able to simulate and compute exactly how these things interact. And I think quantum biology is the sort of first wave of thought in this direction. Not a new field by any means. I mean, Bohr and Einstein and so on were talking about whether their new quantum theory back in the early 1900s could possibly shed light on how life works, because this is one of the biggest, and I think is the last remaining, let's not say last remaining, is one of the hugest mysteries around at the moment. So we have a theory about how the universe began, the Big Bang Theory, which is kind of mainstream science. Theories can, of course, be proven wrong, but at least we have a mainstream theory for that. For life, we don't have a mainstream theory about how life emerged. So there are many competing theories equally probable at this point. So I think life is a huge mystery, the human body being one of the most complex forms of life that we're aware of. So studies in bacteria, which is what my thesis focused on, is really the good place to start, because these are single-celled, simple organisms amongst the first to have emerged on Earth, as far as we know. And even trying to study them is immensely complex, and still there's much debate in the field about what's truly going on there. You have to make approximations. Which approximations you make are then queried by others, as they should be. But I think one thing we can say for sure is that photosynthesis uses quantum effects to achieve its function. It's a highly efficient process in the very early stages, so in the first microsecond, even less, so that's a millionth of a second and less, the first stages are completed, and these stages are quantum mechanical in nature, and this helps them to be almost 100% efficient. This is in terms of the photons being absorbed and transferred, but more importantly in terms of that very first electron that gets transferred. So you need a battery to power the cell, and that means you need to transfer an electron from one place to another so that you have a plus and a minus. And this part of the process is quantum mechanical in nature, and that's what we studied.
Okay. I'd imagine that sort of early life form may be something that you encounter when you eventually get to Mars.
So that's Mars. We think about 4 billion years ago, I've seen different dates, but let's say a few billion years ago, had bodies of liquid water on the surface, as far as we can tell. The erosion patterns in the rocks, and as well as several other forms of evidence, are synonymous with having had large bodies of water. If Mars had large bodies of water, this implies that the temperature was above zero, that other conditions that we think are necessary for life would have prevailed. And indeed, there could have been life at that point. a meteorite that fell from Mars to Earth could have even seeded life on Earth at that point, because we know we have many meteorites from Mars on the surface of the planet Earth. So it could well be that there's been exchange of cells between Earth and Mars in the history of the planets. They both, you know, the solar system is over 4.5 billion years. That's the life of the Earth. So in that time, there are many mysteries that remain about when life emerged, in what form, and so on. So, yeah, although sometimes we feel as though we know a lot, we know very little about in terms of history. We have fossils to go on, but these are really small pieces of the big picture. And I think theoretical science can do a lot to fill in the gaps. And then we need to experiment. We need to dig up fossils, do experiments in the lab, try to synthesize, you know, different scenarios that we see happening. This was some of my postdoctoral work, actually. So the Square Kilometer Array is a really exciting project. International project, and we're hosting a large part of the construction of it here in South Africa. This will be the world's most powerful radio telescope. And what they're doing, what the telescope will do, amongst other things, is to look for prebiotic molecules, so precursors of life. So if we can understand where these precursors come from, how they come together to form a protein, how they come together to form a cell, these are some more of the pieces, as I've said, in the puzzle as to where life came from. Not only looking on Earth, not only on Mars, but also further afield with the radio telescope.
What do you look for? What is the telescope looking for specifically?
So it's a radio telescope, so it looks for frequencies in the radio range. And there are many interesting phenomena in terms of identifying galaxies on that scale. So interactions between large bodies of things in the cosmos far away. So radio waves travel well through space. They don't get interrupted as much as sort of optical frequency light, for example. So we can look really far back in time and really far away from Earth with a much higher precision than before with this radio telescope. So looking for the signatures of complex molecules like amino acids. So glycine is the simplest amino acid. And this has been tentatively discovered in space already, not on a planet, not in an atmosphere, but in an interstellar cloud. So these clouds of dust seem to host these fairly complex molecules. And the precision with which this telescope will be able to look will give us more information than ever before.
Fascinating. Let's talk a bit about Mars. So the Mars One project, how did this opportunity come about? For you?
So, yeah, I mean, I applied to study physics because I thought of being an astronaut. But then since then, I got involved in quantum physics, which is, of course, somehow people then assume that I know all about space and all about everything. But quantum physics is a very different field of physics to astrophysics.
Small,
the very small and the very huge. So I hadn't thought much about being an astronaut again for the last few years, having been really, becoming really passionate about quantum physics. Then I read the article in the newspaper asking for volunteers, well, the call for applications for volunteers to go on a one-way trip to Mars. And this was really a life-changing moment, one of those moments that, you know, will change the rest of your life forever. And I made peace with leaving Earth forever, potentially, in that moment.
Right, and then and there.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, and people were like, how did you make the decision? I said, there was no making, it was made. So I think that's the difference.
You'd already made it, in other words, before.
As I read it, yeah. I knew this was it. And I think the one-way trip, I was actually happy that it was a one-way trip because I knew this would reduce the competition significantly. these applicants would be the ones who were serious about wanting to go, not the ones thinking they would want to visit and then get over it and come back. No. Yeah.
Why is it a one-way trip?
It just depends on the project model. So the Mars One project wants to cut certain corners and try to get it done as soon as possible.
Much cheaper.
Of course, we plan to test everything, but it's cheaper and easier to plan for a one-way trip than to come back. Also, the health questions about how you would readjust to Earth's gravity after spending prolonged time in the Martian environment is not known. So, yeah. It's cutting a lot of corners. And anyway, as we were asked in one of the online interviews, well, this was kind of an exam to get through to one of the next rounds. They said, if you could come back after 4 years, would you? And I said, 4 years, definitely not. I mean, I've just finished a PhD, which took 4 years, and I feel by no means am I finished with the subject matter. I've just like got to the tip of the iceberg, really, in 4 years of research. So I definitely would feel the same on Mars. I would need a lifetime, yes, on a new planet to establish a new world, and I'm happy with that.
So where were you when you got that? Was it a phone call that you received? Was it an email? How did you get the news? Where were you, and what was your immediate reaction?
Of getting into the 100. So reading the newspaper article was the first step. Then it was almost 8 months. And, of course, I left the application till the sort of morning before the deadline and submitted the video. and various other essay-length questions on your psychology and how you react to working in a group and various other questions like that. Yeah, submitted it. Then I was in I knew the email would come through, so I was in Mug and Bean alone. We weren't allowed to tell anyone that we'd been selected in the first group until a date later on. So I made sure I was alone when that happened. Because, yeah, the people in Mug and Bean must have thought I was just gone crazy. But, yeah, no, that was great. Then it became a bit more real. I mean, yeah, it's still a real mix of fantasy and reality. So I've obviously been talking about it and speaking publicly about it and promoting it for years now, almost 4 or 5 years. But there's still obviously that element of fantasy where, like, can this really happen? But, yeah, I believe it will. And it's not often that you get born and being involved in a project that's happening for the first time out of a whole planet, a whole world, a whole history of evolution of life. This is the first time I happen to be here now. And, yes, it sounds fantastical, but so does it always when it's never been done before. And to be a part of this is really a privilege.
I mean, it sounds like the dominant emotion here was excitement, but is there any fear at all as well about this?
No, I think maybe that's just a genetic characteristic where the fear is the excitement. These two are the same. There's never a doubt that the fear would make me turn around. The fear would make me want to rise to the challenge even more. And maybe that is genetic. So my mom has done a lot of research in the family tree and identified all these sort of crazy individuals in our family tree who've gone where no one's gone before and done what no one's done before. Even women who've sort of traveled to new continents and got married. I mean, back in the 1700s, this was unheard of. So I think possibly we're the survivors of a long lineage of semi-crazy explorers, yeah, who've pushed limits beyond that of their counterparts.
Now, you're one of three people from South Africa on the shortlist. In fact, you were saying before we started recording that there are actually four South Africans. One of them is currently living in London.
Yes.
Out of a total of 100 on the shortlist, it really sounds to me like South Africa is punching above its weight here. What's the reason for that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this. So I think the startup community and in terms of startups that have been successful in South Africa, and then you look at California and different areas on the planet seem to be more prone to innovation, and it seems that geographics come into it here. So I think when you live on the edge, let's say, of the continent of Africa, or when the Europeans moved to North America, Europeans and Asians, etc., you know, California was the last outpost. The most sort of pioneering, sort of crazy, let's say, people went the furthest. And maybe that's the case for South Africa too, that those of us who've explored to the edge of the continent and found that that's then the edge, then settle and can continue to innovate with that kind of spirit of exploration. I'm proud to be amongst these South Africans and amongst these 100. And I think I've met several of the other 100, and without fail, you're a bit apprehensive at first because, you know, this is just a stranger at the end of the day, but you're both part of this crazy project to go and live on Mars. And without fail, we've all got on because we all have this sense in us that this is going to happen, that this is not crazy, this is something that we can work towards and achieve. And that common characteristic, brings us together.
How many people go in the end, and when do they decide on that final list?
So the call for production companies to submit their applications to be the producer of the show that will accompany the selection and the training and the departure and the arrival and living on Mars. Obviously, this is a big contract to be signed. It wouldn't be good to have swap outs during the process. So choosing the broadcast is fairly important, I think, and that the deadline for that was a couple of months ago. So they haven't announced yet who the production company will be. But once this is decided, then together they will fix a date. We're hoping end of this year, early next year, to select down to 40, first of all, then from 40 down to 24. But, I mean, I think what I've learned through this process is take everything with a pinch of salt. I think all 100 of us have shown our dedication through these last 4 to 5 years, being involved with the project, devoting our time and effort towards promoting this idea that we are passionate about. And I think probably all of us will have the opportunity to go if it works. So the idea is to train 24, but the rest will be on standby, let's say. And then there are other projects who will also need crew. And this is going to be an interesting, possibly, collaboration between...
Yeah.
People like SpaceX, Boeing, Lockheed Martin. There are only so many NASA astronauts, and I'm not sure how many of them are prepared to go on a first ever trip. I'm not sure what the legal government taxpayer implications are of sending, you know, US citizens on a risky trip. Whereas we're volunteers, we're private citizens. This is an international non-profit plus for-profit. It's split into two, but yeah.
You mentioned Elon Musk. I wanted to ask a bit about him. Is he involved in this at all? I know that he's stated many times that he wants to send people to Mars. He's building the Falcon Heavy rocket, which I understand Mars One is hoping to use to get to the red planet. Is what he's doing quite different to what the Mars One project is looking at? Or do you think the projects might merge at some point?
Yeah, so South African-born Elon Musk actually made a revolution in spaceflight happen on the 30th of March, so just a few weeks ago, where the Falcon 9 is the precursor, I guess you could say, to the Falcon Heavy, but the Falcon 9 is currently used to launch cargo to the International Space Station and launch satellites and so on, and they make NASA's one of their customers then to do these launches. So they managed to launch and re-land the Falcon 9 on a barge at sea, remotely controlled, then relaunch that same rocket and re-land it. So reusability only now has really been demonstrated by actually reusing that same rocket that was re-landed. And this is a revolution because it will reduce the cost of space flight by, I think the amounts have been said, over 50%, but I believe far more. I mean, now their aim is to get this turnover time down to 24 hours, like an airplane arriving in an airport, doing some basic checks and refueling and then relaunching. And that's their aim with SpaceX. And the grand goal for SpaceX in doing this is to make humans a multi-planetary species. And I was actually in Mexico at the conference, the IAC, International Astronautical Congress, in last year, where Elon made this announcement publicly for the first time on his project model to send humans to Mars. And to hear someone talking with such detailed engineering knowledge on the subject, so he will be building the hardware, and I believe with the steps that they've already taken, my money would be behind him that they're going to get it right first. He plans to send 100 people at a time.
Wow.
And to basically have a craft that's in low Earth orbit, and then to do multiple launches from Earth to fill it with cargo, people, etc.,
and bring people back.
Yeah, he plans to do a return trip. So, I mean, who the technical support crew will be on this mission remains is still, I guess, an unanswered question. Whether or not the Mars One crew may then play a role in having already been trained for this purpose, because Elon plans to send civilians.
Right.
When asked by a member of the audience how long these 100 crew personnel would train for, he said 3 days. So in my opinion, yeah, maybe it's possible to send 100 people who've trained for 3 days, but not without a skilled team of engineers with the deep knowledge of the systems that you'll be relying on the way there, on landing, etc. So there could be a collaboration in the end. I mean, Elon said if Mars One wants a Falcon Heavy, then they're welcome to buy one. And so it's just a matter of raising the money. So I think all of it's very interesting, not well-defined, I would say. But certainly the hardware developers are working hard to develop the hardware. And I think the dedication of the Mars 100 means that the people are ready too. And there's nothing left standing between us and the new world on Mars.
So what's the business model behind Mars One? You spoke about this television production project. Is that going to be a big part of the model here?
Yeah, so as I've said, and as Elon Musk has said, and I think as all entrepreneurs say, the more people developing towards a certain impossible solution, the more chance you have of this diversity of approaches succeeding. So I think we're going to develop the hardware, whether it's Boeing, Lockheed Martin, SpaceX, SpaceX being at the forefront of the developments right now, in my opinion. So then the question for Mars One is, how are they going to afford this technology? So they've estimated the cost of getting the first four there at around $10 billion US. Which is probably an underestimate, but let's say a few tens of billions of US dollars to get the first four there. And that's on a minimum model of a one-way trip, of course. Where will they get this money from? Well, the funding model is actually entirely believable the more you think about it. It's based on the fact that if you have an interesting enough event that billions of viewers worldwide will watch this event, and through advertising and general means of making revenue on a globally watched event, you can generate on the order of $10 billion US. So this is based on the London Olympic Games generating on this order of revenue purely in broadcasting alone during the 4 years running up and during the screening of the London Olympic Games. I still need to check the figures for the Rio Games, but so for a 10-year TV show, let's say, building up to the development of all the hardware, the training of the crew, the simulation training that will take place in various isolated locations on Earth, in Norway where they test rovers, for example, in Antarctica, which is a good approximation of the kind of isolation that we would experience there, deserts that have similar conditions in some ways to Mars, so you can approximate Martian conditions in various different aspects. I think this will make for exciting viewing for, supporters and critics alike, and in this way I think the $10 billion is totally generatable through this model. And as the program gains in momentum and gains traction. And as people see the hardware, the line or the gap between what's needed and what's being developed closing in, I think then investors will also start getting on board. Because this will be the new world. And I think if you wait to see whether our landing on Mars is successful or not, that will be too late to get involved in terms of being an early investor. So I think investors out there should also start thinking about space as the next frontier of the economy.
You'll be globally famous if you go. How do you feel about that?
So that's kind of a weird thought, because you'd never be able to come back to Earth to check whether you really were famous or not, you know. So maybe your Twitter followers will increase overnight. But no, I think the platform for, yeah, in some ways, what you say then will have a weight that is not even comparable to, you know, the most, I don't know, well-listened to politicians on Earth. So that's something I take very seriously, the effect that my opinion may have on my followers on Earth. And I think all of us do, and I don't think any of us are in it for the personal glory. It's too much of a difficult a difficult mission for that. There are far easier ways to generate personal glory than deciding to go on a one-way trip to Mars. So I think we have that in common, at least the Mars 100 that I've met. And I think it's really about celebrating our humanity. It's something we all share in. We'll be the ones actually going to Mars, but eventually others will follow. We'll set up an environment where others can live, and this is really the first step for all of us, not just for the few that make it there. And it's about creating knowledge, at least for me. So it's curiosity that drives me primarily. If other people are going to go somewhere where people have never been before, I will do everything I can to be with them and see it firsthand. That's the primary goal. But secondly is to create knowledge. I mean, that's what we do as humans. We're the only species that we know of that have developed communication networks, the internet, ways to store knowledge, to transfer knowledge, not only through language and like directly with each other, but in, you know, our capacity to store knowledge in disks and so on, databases. So I think what we will do on Mars is really to extend that capability of what it is to be human, which is to generate knowledge, to build our technology, to be able to sustain ourselves in vastly different environments to the one that we came from.
So there's a lot of prep work ahead before you even get on that spaceship. What's involved? What are you going to have to go through over the next 10 to 15 years?
I feel like I'm ready to go now. I mean, if you told me this was the last interview I'm doing before getting on that rocket, I would be ready in a heartbeat. So I think the training, of course, for me as a theorist is largely around the practical aspects of how to fix things. So of course, we'll have communication with Earth. And for those who've watched The Martian, you know how crucial that is to have communication, because you can get code patches, you can get 3D printing designs sent in, you can get a wealth of knowledge and like teams of hundreds of experts working on solving your problems, and then the information can be transferred to you. So the skills that you will need on Mars are really for those situations where 20 minutes is too much. So you need to be able to work under pressure, because as in your capacity as being present there on Mars, you will need to do emergency surgeries, fix electronics components that have broken immediately because this is the life support system and the battery's failed or whatever. So it's about fixing immediate emergency problems with your hands. So our robots are not yet sophisticated enough to be able to do these kind of tasks. So as humans, this is what we're there for, to be able to fix these unexpected emergency situations. So we'll need a lot of training for that, to know the habitat that we'll be living in inside out. We need to be able to take apart the rovers, put them back together, build new components based on other components, feeding things into the 3D printer. Printing, we'll have a 3D printer, which helps. We'll rely on technology hugely, but also our ingenuity as humans to fix unforeseen problems.
So it really calls on someone who's a multidisciplinarian.
Yeah, and someone who can be calm, I think, and think about problems. So in my capacity as a theoretical physicist, I feel like my problem-solving capacity.
So, Adriana, tell me what it's going to be like. It's a 7-month journey to Mars, is that right?
Currently 7 months. So the Curiosity rover, which is sort of a one-ton object, we'll be traveling with sort of 20 to 50 tons of stuff, the humans, the technology, everything we need. So whether or not we'll be able to decrease this time frame to get there or not is a question, but let's say a few months for sure. Yeah.
So I guess you don't suffer from claustrophobia at all. I mean, you're going to be in a small spaceship for 7 months. You're then going to be in a colony in a very small space, at least initially. Not an issue for you, small spaces.
No, I don't think so. I mean, knowing that you're alone on a planet, I think that's in stark contrast to the vast loneliness of being the only four people on a planet. So, I think being able to rise above your immediate physical environment and imagine mentally just the space that you're in is going to be the way that we get through this. So I think meditation and really just staying calm and trying to not see the physical environment for what it is, but just the stepping stone to make the next giant leap will be important.
Yeah. Okay. So what happens when you get there? Do you orbit for a while? Do you do reconnaissance? I presume you've already decided where you're going to land and set up the colony. What's actually involved in a landing on Mars, and what happens immediately after you land?
So landing is difficult. I mean, the European Space Agency unsuccessfully tried to land something on Mars a few months ago. The orbital mission was successful, so I think we're better at inserting things into orbit. Obviously, this is less complicated than landing them on the surface. And NASA is actually the only entity agency that's managed to successfully land objects on Mars. We're getting better at it, though. So since the year 2000, the success rate of landing things on Mars has gone over 80% on average with everything we've tried. But this is a risky part. So it depends on the project design again. So Lockheed Martin has proposed to put like an international space station, but in the Martian atmosphere orbit, or low Martian orbit. if they are successful in doing this before we leave, then that would mean that there is some kind of station in orbit on Mars, which we could rendezvous with. I'm not an expert in exact plans for this, but if we follow the model of the Curiosity rover, this will not be possible because it's one ton, we'll be 50. So I think if people want more detail on that, Elon's YouTube video on making humans a multiplanetary species describes how he would achieve the landing with 100 crew. I would trust the engineers to design this as best as possible, but I think we would go straight into landing. Mm-hmm. The idea with the Mars One project is to have the rovers already on the ground, having erected some part of the habitat beforehand.
Oh, yes. Okay.
So the first part of the Mars One project would be to put the satellites in orbit to ensure communication between Mars and Earth. Two of these satellites would achieve that. Then the next step would be to land the rovers, who will scout for the exact location. Then they would, after several cargo missions being landed in this vicinity, the rovers would begin to set up the central part of the habitat, so that when the crew arrives, there would be a pressurized, temperature-regulated it's a pod or whatever you would call it. You can look at the images online, ready for us to sleep in at least for those first few nights before we begin to expand the habitat.
Okay. So what's the longer term plan for the colony? How big does it eventually get? How many people do you actually want on Mars? What's the ideal number? And what do you hope to achieve there?
So I think it's the establishment of a new world. I mean, some people get the impression that it's this lonely, brave journey of four people that get there and land there and eventually die there after doing some science. I think that's not my opinion at all about what this mission is. This mission is about demonstrating livability, in which case floods of people will start to leave from Earth to come to Mars. I'm not talking about the next 5 years. I'm talking about the next 100 years. Once it's been demonstrated that this is the next frontier, this is where technological development is happening faster than any place on Earth. Why? Because it's necessary for survival. Why? Because the kind of people who are there are also the creative, pioneering, exploratory types who, when put in one group, become a really creative bunch, as we've seen happen in locations on Earth. I think the US being the sort of superpower right now, if they can be classified as that, is not accidental that this is also the newest kind of area that we've built on and turned into cities and so on. So I believe Mars will be the next frontier, probably after I'm dead, but this is my prediction for the future. In the short term, we'll be trying to survive. So Elon Musk's view of what will happen on Mars is a much grander plan than sort of Mars One. From what I've heard, so Mars One incrementally plans to increase the population by around 4 people every 2 years, maybe more once the hardware has been demonstrated and they can expand on that and send more than 4 at a time. Elon, on the other hand, wants to send 100 and possibly in multiple groups of 100 each 2 years. So the reason for 2 years is that the launch, it's 26 months. Every 26 months, there's a launch window to Mars that's the most fuel-efficient way to get there. So staggered in 2 years, it depends whose model it is, of whether they're going to be 100 or 4 people or hundreds of people being launched. Elon said everyone from pizza oven, people carrying pizza ovens, to metal foundry components will be on board. So he really plans to set up industry on the surface, including pizza restaurants. So really the establishment of a new world in all the senses that you would imagine.
I mean, how livable can we make Mars eventually? I mean, you see, watch Star Trek and you hear about terraforming. Is that something humans could do to Mars at some point in the future?
Sure. I mean, what we're doing on Earth here in terms of modifying the climate, as terrible as all of that is for the Earth's environment, it could be seen as some kind of training for terraforming is to change the climate on a global level. We're seeing now how carbon dioxide can do that. And this is the kind of line of thinking of Elon Musk and others. Mm. So Elon Musk, of course, has some ideas on this, but I've also read research articles from previous decades on how we could go about turning Mars into a livable environment. So first of all, you need temperature. So life needs water, at least Earth life needs water. So you need the temperature to be on average above zero to be able to put these sort of cyanobacteria into the water. On Earth, I mean, Earth has only had an oxygenated atmosphere for the last 2 billion years or so. So that's less than half of its life. Previously, it had a different atmosphere, no oxygen in that. So if we wanted to oxygenate Mars's atmosphere, we could do the same that we believe to have happened here on Earth, which is that cyanobacteria, oxygenic cyanobacteria, performing oxygenic photosynthesis, started absorbing the carbon dioxide, emitting oxygen on a large scale, so that oxygenation was achieved a few hundreds of millions of years later. So we need to warm Mars up. How do we do that? Well, we need to have a thick atmosphere, thicker than the one that is currently there, because Mars has a pressure of less than 1% of Earth at the moment, so a very thin atmosphere. The idea could be to release the carbon dioxide trapped in the poles. So when you see pictures of Mars and it's got these white polar caps, this is not largely water, but largely carbon dioxide. If we could melt that somehow, that could be a source of carbon dioxide. How to keep that atmosphere in, given that Mars no longer has a magnetic field, is another question. There are several proposals, though, for generating a planetary-wide, global, let's say, magnetic field. So if we can achieve the magnetic field to keep the atmosphere in place, plus some kind of carbon cycle that we use living systems to modulate and to keep in place, as is here on Earth, we could potentially have a situation that's warm enough and got enough oxygen for us to breathe. But these processes take at least sort of tens of thousands of years, given current models. But of course, we've never tried it, so for sure some entrepreneurs will come up with quicker ways to do it eventually. But I'm not sure I'll be alive to see that. So for now, I think we're looking at large sort of covered structures, either underground or on the surface, dome-like areas where we make a habitat that's livable for plants and humans and potentially animals. But actually turning the atmosphere into one that's similar to Earth is a far longer-term goal.
Out of curiosity, the gravity on Mars is significantly less. I think you said it's one-third of Earth's
38%
gravity.
38% of Earth, yeah.
What does that do to your body in the long term?
So we know what happens to the body in the microgravity, which is essentially zero gravity in the space station, for periods of 6 months and 1 year lately. Scott Kelly and Mikhail Kurienko spent 1 year in the space station. They're still being studied now to see the effects. Scott Kelly actually has an identical twin who remained on Earth during his year in space, so very interesting physiological comparisons being done now. So this is like zero gravity. On Mars, there's 38% gravity, so this is not at all the severe conditions of having no gravity. And we don't have to readjust to coming back to Earth. So that's the main question with these astronauts, is that when they come back to Earth, they suffer all the pains and of readjusting to the full gravitational field of Earth. If we go to Mars, we'll probably adjust to that gravitational field, and if we don't need to come back, there may not be any detrimental effects here. So yes, your bones get less dense, but if you're living in a 38% gravitational field, you don't need bones as dense as the ones you needed on Earth. Your muscles will become less, because you don't use them as much, because things are easier in 38% gravity. But then if you're not coming back to Earth, you would adjust to a level that's required by that environment. So in terms of other effects, like effects on eyesight and so on, we just don't know. But my feeling is that a 38% gravitational field is probably something you'll adjust to. And unless you need to come back, is something you can... Yeah.
Which you're not planning to do. We're almost out of time. Just a couple more questions before I let you go, Adriana. You're raring to go. You'd jump on the rocket tomorrow if you could. But just talk to me about what you think it's going to take mentally to prepare for a trip like this, psychological preparation. What's required? And what about having a family? Is this something you've given up on? It's something you've sacrificed as part of this mission to Mars?
I think an important part of the psychology of being able to volunteer for this mission and do it successfully is that you should not feel as though you've sacrificed a single thing.
Right.
I think that will that will destroy you in the end if you feel as though this has been a secondary choice for something that you would rather have done. So every one of us who wants to go to Mars needs to be sure that this is what we want to do. For me, having a family is not a priority. I'm an aunt and I'm about to be an aunt again, and I feel happy that the family line will be continued without me having to contribute to the 7 billion plus population on planet Earth. I think it's important that a lot of us on this planet start to have priorities other than just, you know, breeding, because this is no longer something we need to do. This is something ingrained in us as biological systems, but we've now reached a tipping point where our population is too much. So I think it's important to find goals other than having a family. Of course, having a family is a wonderful thing, but I think those amongst us who feel we have other priorities should be celebrated, because we need these people. I think it's important to make sure that you're at peace with making this decision, that this is really the grandest outcome for your life. I think those small splinters of doubt will eventually lead to problems in the group. I think we'll rely on each other a lot, of course. So while we won't be having families here on Earth, or some of us do already, the people that we go with will become our family, friends, mentors, children, aunts, uncles. Everyone that we lived in a community with here on Earth will be replaced with a smaller group of people on Mars. And I think support for each other, we'll be trained in counseling, psychology, but I think empathy and just appreciation for those people and the fact that your life, all of our survival will depend on all of us. So I think that really close-knit group will be a really important aspect of the success.
Adrian, you're now working at SAP as Head of Innovation for Africa. What does that job entail, and does it help you get ready for the Mars One opportunity?
Yeah, so I'm always one to take an opportunity, and this one came along, and it was fantastic, and of course not something I was going to say no to, although I did say, if the rocket's ready to leave tomorrow, you know where my priorities lie.
Can't blame
you. No, so in the meantime, I think the business world is a whole new sphere of research for me now, something I didn't know much about, having been in the idealistic world of theoretical research for the rest of my life. So I'm well-trained in problem-solving. I'm well-trained in understanding the complexities of a situation, trying to see beyond those, trying to find a sort of simple solution that makes sense to as many parties as possible. And I feel like this is kind of how the business world works, and I'm finding it absolutely fascinating. As always, I see a challenge as an opportunity. So I think being in Africa is something I'm specifically excited about, because I think we have so many opportunities here in Africa to kind of leapfrog over industries that have already been born and died in the mature markets, let's say. So, for example, we go straight to mobile. We don't have on-premise databases in many companies. We can go straight to cloud. We can go straight to solutions that are just emerging now in the mature market as a global company like SAP, if we're clever about seeing what's going on. And I think there are many fresh, exciting ideas in Africa. We're let's not talk about Africa as a single place, but I think on the continent in general, we are used to taking risks. We are used to changes, political changes, all sorts of different changes that we've seen in our lifetimes, whereas mature markets are used to a more sort of consistent environment. So I think being not so risk averse is really an opportunity here for us to do fantastic things. And I think the Square Kilometer Array being built here in South Africa, which will generate more data than any other entity on the planet Earth, so 160 terabytes a second when it's finished, will be hugely important for development and data acquisition, analysis, storage, the data scientists that we'll need to train to support this data. I mean, the SKA has already given many scholarships to students and researchers to begin to look towards solving these problems. There's the world's first drone port is being planned in Rwanda. So these are just two world firsts that are happening here on the continent. So this is really a port for drones. So again, let's leapfrog. Let's say our roads are not great. How can we deliver small packages like pharmaceuticals, electronic spare parts to remote regions where the roads are not great? Drones. Now we need a drone port. We need drones to check in, take their cargo, etc. And these are, two world firsts happening here in Africa. I think there's a lot we can be proud of being in a place of such innovation like the continent of Africa.
Dr. Adriana Maria, thank you so much for joining us on the Tech Central podcast. This has been a brilliant discussion, and we wish you all the best of luck, and we're holding thumbs that you're going to be one of the final selected candidates to go to Mars, and looking forward to your future progress.
Thanks. I hope so too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.